Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. On Wednesday, November 4 at 7:30 p.m., political scientist and historian Michael Parenti will give a free public lecture at the University of Hartford titled Civil Liberties and Economic Democracy. You'll need to reserve your free ticket at the university box office. I'll give phone numbers at the end of the show. If you misplace the number, just remember University of Hartford box office. How hard could that be to look up? Anyway, Parenti's fine mind, impressive scholarship, left-of-center perspective, and great sense of humor make his talks well worth listening to. We talked privately by phone on October 13. In truth, Michael talked more than I did. In the first half of this show, Parenti develops 3 points. First, empires are very costly, and the cost is borne by the empire's common people. That's why the U.S. is broke, and we're broke. Second, by now the state is no longer sovereign. The state, including its government, is now the servant of transnational neoliberal capitalism. And third, our country's supposed foreign enemies are, and our wars are with, any state that attempts any economic independence. That's why the U.S. government socked it to Iraq and to Yugoslavia. To Grenada, too, you'll recall. And why the powers that be can hardly wait to sock it to Iran and Venezuela. After that, a brief musical break, then back to the conversation with Michael Parenti.
Well, I was driving home today from the station and listening on a CD of a talk you gave, I guess it was 1992 or thereabouts, The Cost of Empire, mm-hmm. from your Real Politics series. Mm-hmm. And I was just struck about how little you'd have to change to to play that record again today.
The point I make there is that one of the costs of empire, or much of the costs of empire, are paid by the people mm-hmm. of the imperial nation. You talk about a stimulus package now that Obama was bringing up, a $700 mm-hmm. billion dollar stimulus package, which mm-hmm. was so controversial. And Republicans talked about it as a budget buster and just spend, and were opposing it and voted almost unanimously against it. But we've had for the last half a century a stimulus package every year, and that's called the military budget. Mm-hmm. It's now up to close to $700 billion if you take into account all the anti-missile programs and everything in the Department of Energy that's for the Department of Defense and so forth. Put it all together with veterans' costs and benefits, it's well over $700 billion every year. Mm-hmm. That's paying for the empire. The empire feeds off the republic. The empire gets its manpower. The young men and women who die in these wars, far-off wars, are from our population for the most part. Although empires have often had a care to recruit foreign troops, too, or native troops mm-hmm. in different areas, who, because of their poverty and lack of opportunities, would often enlist and join this empire or that, which explains why the British Army, right even into World War II, had ethnic units of one kind or another. Mm-hmm. So did the American Army have. We had Asian troops, Japanese American troops, and special units. We had African-American troops and special units and such. So for the most part, the payments in money and in blood come from the republic. So you have an empire that's continually to build, mm-hmm. that's winning victory after victory, and the empire, the whole imperial system, is itself beginning to decay and go down. The dollar may no longer be the reserve. We may end up with a disastrous inflation for all of us. The poverty of the republic, and you take more and more federal funding, you no longer give federal subsidies to states and municipalities, and because you got to spend that money in Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever else. Mm-hmm. Well, you have shortages wherever you go. I travel around this country quite a bit. So I go around the country, and it sounds like, I feel like I'm in the same community every time I pick up the local newspaper mm-hmm. and hear city council facing fiscal crises, state legislature cutting services, library closing, public hospital closing. We are fast becoming a third world country. Almost all our social services have been slowly defunded. Mm-hmm. And that's not only because of the cost of empire. That was a deliberate policy of the Republican Party, which today is a hard right-wing reactionary party determined to roll everything back, get rid of minimum wages, get rid of child labor laws, get rid of Social Security, get rid of everything that's made life under capitalism somewhat sufferable, and get us back to 1900. That's their goal, it seems. So the empire comes in handy in that way. The costs are tremendous. The U.S. military is the single largest polluter in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing militaries do is they continually train. That's all they do. Either they fight or they're trained to fight. And that training, that constant maneuvers, that constant testing and all that, takes a terrific toll on the environment in terms of pollution, fossil fuel consumption, toxic waste, chemical waste of all sorts. Totally unregulated, I mean, unlike the corporations and such, under the guise of security considerations.
Mm-hmm.
So you got that. You got the fact that hundreds of soldiers die every year just in accidents in the military. You get a 19-year-old and you give them a huge, powerful, armored vehicle to drive. That's not necessarily a very good mix.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of blood and life and impoverishment, the empire really cannot afford too many more victories. Now, if you look at the other side of it, the empire is triumphant. It rolled back the entire Soviet superpower and its the opposition. It now has major bases in Central Asia, which, I mean, years ago it could only dream of extending into Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
It has bases in Eastern Europe, in Yugoslavia, and other places. And an aggrandizing, relentless empire like the U.S. empire, it can only see two kinds of nations. Ones that are satellites, and those are called allies, and they're the ones that say, yes, as you say, whatever you want, mm-hmm. we'll open up our markets, you bring your investors in, here it is, our labor, our natural resources, our capital, and our markets, it's all for you. Those are called friendly to the U.S., good to the U.S. Either they have satellites or they have enemies. The other countries that try to strike out on their own, who say we want good relations with you, but leave us alone, to develop their own destiny, self-developing, self-defining, mm-hmm. those countries are designated as enemies, such as Iraq and Venezuela and Libya under Gaddafi for many years.
And Grenada.
As small as Grenada, Panama, yeah, mm-hmm. Somalia, yeah, and just about every country in Latin America at one time or another, just about every country in Asia at one time or another. The list of interventions to make sure that these governments and these movements do not chart a different course from the global free market, open market, one-sided trade arrangement that the U.S. has in support of global transnational corporate capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, they've got a couple of large countries like Russia and China, and they are already preparing. They're constantly trying to lay the groundwork, at least when Bush was in, as to why we should fear and hate and begin to threaten Russia and put long-range ballistic missiles in Poland, set up a Star Wars anti-missile system to make the nuclear weapons of China and Russia useless, you know, mm-hmm. you can block them off, anticipating some kind of war and the like. So it seems like it's a worldview of supremacy, accumulate, plunder, profit, everything in the world, everybody's labor, everybody's resources, everybody's capital, everybody's markets mm-hmm. should all be in the service of this powerful global U.S. investor class. And this empire.
Which leads to the question of the nation state. When you look at the actions of the government of the United States, and particularly their foreign policy, it seems to be the government seems to be subordinate to the economic elite, we're sending the troops in order to make the world safe for capitalism. We're having the U.S. trade representative twist China's arm to make China safe for imports of American cigarettes. Is the government doing anything as a traditional government would do, or do you see it as entirely subordinate to the economic multinational capitalists?
I see them as essentially subordinate to multinational or transnational capitalism, corporate capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
There are some differences between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Republican president, George Bush, as you know, welcomed the first war of the 21st century and had a view that there were going to be many wars. The Republican candidate, John McCain, announced that there are going to be many more wars. They envision a world of wars to mm-hmm. come, which the U.S. will be directly or indirectly engaged in one way or the other. And this is the world because they are thieves. They are bullies, and they want to grab everything they can. Barack Obama talks with a fig leaf. He talks a friendlier, less threatening, less belligerent line. But he's pushing and supporting both of those wars, Iraq, and he's now going to be sending a large group contingent to Afghanistan. They just don't mm-hmm. get it, you know. They just think they can pull this one off, you know.
And now he's essentially starting a war in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Another Muslim country. This one's different in that it does have the bomb, as opposed to Iraq, which didn't have the bomb.
Yeah, well, in Pakistan, but under the guise of rooting out the Al-Qaeda
mm-hmm,
and
course.
Taliban sympathizers and such.
Mm-hmm.
He did do things like he, for instance, did not put those intercontinental ballistic missiles into Poland, which would have just been a outrageous provocation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be like the Russians putting intercontinental ballistic missiles
in Cuba.
In Cuba,
yeah,
right, which almost caused World War III right there,
mm-hmm.
or putting them in Mexico or something like this,
and, yeah,
just over the border. And it's outrageous that the existing Polish government had their heart set on it. I mean, they just so fawningly, like a bunch of, you know, just running along there like a little skiff behind the American battleship and clinging to it adoringly. Unfair to many Poles who opposed the bringing in of these missiles. There are many people in Poland. So the government's position was not really that representative of the Polish population. They understood that you put those missiles in and we become a ground zero first strike target of Soviet missiles. That's, mm-hmm. that's what you invite when you have if I got something here that can destroy you, you pay keen and not very friendly attention to me suddenly. So Obama has not done that, and instead he's doing these intermediate things and aiming them more directly at Iran. And again, because Iran is daring to chart its own course,
mm-hmm.
I have no admiration for the present government in Iran. I think it's been a repressive and murderous government in some respects, but it also has been independent, like Iraq with Saddam Hussein, who was a brutal dictator. And when he was a dictator at his most murderous time, he was loved by
the Cheneys and the Rumsfelds, especially.
In Washington, D.C. He was their boy. They loved him.
Mm-hmm.
It was only when he started getting out of line with the oil quotas and oil prices, he was committing economic nationalism, and they had no had no tolerance of that. The whole economy in Iraq was still state-owned.
Mm-hmm.
So that was enough reason to get rid of him. And I think the same with Iran. They don't care that the Iran government is killing and torturing students and protesters and all that. They just care that Iran is charting its own course and owning its own oil and selling its own oil on the market. Instead of the cartels directly owning it, they got to buy it from Iran to retail it here in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just make a middleman profit, but they want the whole enchilada there. And so they're threatening. And Iran is actually just simply upgrading their uranium, which is perfectly within the rights of
Under the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty.
Yeah, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty.
Oh, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Act.
That's it. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation, if I could pronounce it, Proliferation yeah. Act, enriched in uranium is perfectly fine. It's what you need for, you know, for nuclear power and such. And Iran knows, yeah, they've got the big oil reserve, but in 20 years, that reserve may run out, assuming the globe has 20 more years of to can sustain fossil fuel consumption at that level. So they want to build peaceful nuclear power. There's no evidence that really that they're planning great bombs to strike. They know if they hit Israel on a first strike, they would get it back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so they're not building. Well, there are countries, though, that might want to build nuclear weapons, like North Korea, because they know something which everybody seems to have overlooked here. I wrote an article on that. It's on my website, Sanity at the Brink, I think I called it that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that the North Koreans know that the U.S. has never attacked a country that has nuclear weapons. They only attack and invade and subvert countries that don't have nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
This is why the North Koreans are making a big show of having a weapons, you know. The Iranians have to proceed far more cautiously because they know that Israel will look for very little excuse to come and attack them in a terrible way. If there is a war with Iran, the Western forces will not do what they did in Iraq. They won't send an army in because Iran is twice the size of Iraq, and hilly, too, and larger population. They would need 1 million troops, at least, to try to. And there's no way. That's the weak Achilles heel in the empire, is the manpower.
Mm-hmm.
Although with the recession now, they are meeting their recruitment quotas. So they wouldn't attack Iran with an invasion, but they would do more like what they did with Yugoslavia, that is just destroy it from the air, hit every utility, power station, hotel, hospital, you know, whatever,
mm-hmm.
all those things, just simply bomb it back into total destitution.
Watch World War III on pay TV. If you want to keep the kids at home, they'll be glued to their sets, watching rockets and jets, blowing up schools and factories, putting an end to the birds and bees. It's worth every penny to tune in and see.
Bum, bum, bum.
Who wins the Emmy at the ruins of the Academy? Watch World War III on pay TV.
Close-ups on the screen.
Not a face you know.
Isn't this better than Bishop Sheen?
Better than the Late Late Show?
Watching the boys from your hometown
fighting whoever they are.
Watching the cities falling down.
It's greater than Jack Barr.
They're out setting up the cameras now. Though they don't know just where, still they've got to prepare. Murrow's there to do his part.
Crown City 4 from circa 1960, and ouch, that piccolo gives me a headache. I'll bet the Pittsburgh police use piccolos to abuse and disorient demonstrators at the G20. Can't you just see them deputizing the entire woodwind section of the Pittsburgh Symphony? arming them with police-issue piccolos, then shouting, "Now go kick your drum!" In the last part of our conversation, Michael Parenti spoke on two topics. One, many republics have metastasized into empires, and many empires have collapsed under their own weight. Can the people turn an empire around before it all comes crashing down? And the final topic, by, say, 1960, the United States seemed to be well into the process of turning into a social democracy, such as Sweden. Today, we're much farther away from that goal than we were then. What happened? Here's Michael Parenti.
Michael, your knowledge of history is apparently very, very extensive, certainly much better than mine. You know, we all know a lot of examples of republics that have turned into empires and then collapsed. Can you think of an example in which the republic turned into an empire and then the citizens were able to turn it back again, turn it back into a republic before it collapsed and was destroyed?
Yeah, Great Britain.
Great Britain.
Yeah, they came out of World War II with an empire unequaled in human history. It was the one they had when they went into World War II.
Uh-huh.
And they realized that they, you know, Churchill, who was an imperialist, who said, "I am not prime minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire." I got to work on my Churchill imitation, I think. But in fact, they came out of the war utterly depleted, utterly impoverished, and they went the way of a social democracy. They voted in the Labour Party. Churchill was totally staggered here. He had brought the country through this whole war and triumph and all that. He thought he'd be hailed as this, like the emperor coming back with a triumphus. The Romans called it a triumphus. It was a celebratory march that a victorious general would have. There'd be all sorts of celebrations and statements made by his troops and such. A triumph. But instead, the Brits voted in Clement Attlee and the Socialist Party, the Labour Party, and embarked upon a program of socialized medicine, retirement pensions, disability insurance, expansion of public education, and said, "The hell with that goddamn empire," because they knew they weren't prospering from that empire. That empire was for the benefit of the Bank of England and the East India Company and a bunch of corporations and such. And also, there simply was no way to hang on to it. I mean, India was ready for its independence, and nothing was going to stop that, even with the terrible partition. And then the various countries in Africa also, many of them former British colonies, fought. And they continued fighting. It wasn't all in 1945-47. Some had to keep fighting into the 50s, I guess, like Kenya and places like that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The British hung on, I guess, to quite a bit, didn't they? Rhodesia and other places. But their empire just went the way. And their ruling class and their investment class was secure in the fact, in a hostile world, anti-colonial, emergent throughout the Third World, and the communist, emerging communist world, they were at least secure in the fact that a big, global, powerful last stand was being taken by their close ally, the United States. So the U.S. came in and picked up the tab and the superstructure of global empire, and the British did survive. That's one example I guess I can give.
Uh-huh, okay.
Maybe we can do the same. Maybe we can, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that leads to the question I had in mind. What's with the Americans? I know you're a big believer in democracy and think the world would be a better place if there were more of it. And you look at the Americans, and we're sitting around on our fatty acids. You know, we're couch potatoes. We every new assault against us by the powers that be, we just roll over and say, "Thank you, sir." I've been saying for number of years, and the only established person I've heard say this was Vincent Bugliosi, is that, you know, in November of 2000, we had a coup d'etat in this country, and nobody even noticed, apparently. Well, you noticed, Vincent noticed, I noticed, but nobody's saying anything.
Yeah. Yeah, the election was stolen, and it was stolen again in 2004.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the campaign to undo the social democracy in the U.S., the social wage, began in really concertedly. Well, it was always there was always the right wing campaign opposing that, but it really picked up steam in 1980, 81, too, with the advent of Ronald Reagan. He was the one who made war upon the. Upon the social democracy. Actually, in 1978, Jimmy Carter got the word from ruling interests who said, hey, we are moving toward a social democracy. This thing ought to be, this thing's got to be
reversed.
Cooled, you know, reversed. So I used to argue back then. I said, we've had 2 years of Reaganism before Reagan. Jimmy Carter turned around between 78 and 80. Mm-hmm. He started increasing military spending. He started cutting human services and social wage things. Started cutting back on environmental stuff and such and regulatory things. He was preparing the way for Reagan, but he still had to be friends with labor and with African American voters. No, they were a big chunk of his base vote, and so the ruling class said, "We've had enough of Carter. Let's really go and start the rollback." Uh-huh. And one of the components of that rollback is also massive deficit spending. You pile up a debt, all the while accusing your opponents. I mean, one of the things the Republican reactionaries have done for these 20 years is continually attack the Democrats for supposedly doing the things that the Republicans actually were doing. The Republicans were the biggest wild-eyed spenders there were, and the like.
But
so
military
it started
spending
with Reagan and went on with George Bush Sr., and of course these last 8 years with Bush Jr. have been disastrous. And now what we have is a centrist Democrat, another one like Clinton, whose concern is really to accommodate the powers that be, but take on some fringe changes and, wedge things, marginal things, and get them a little better, raise the... The minimum wage has been raised to $7 an hour now, $7.25, I forget. But facing an economic disaster of momentous dimensions and really not being able to do anything about it because he's too busy restoring Wall Street to its health.
Yes. Speaking of, when you come to the University of Hartford in early November, you're going to be speaking on economic democracy. And I'm struck how seldom one finds those two words put together like that.
Yes, that's right.
Democracy is a matter of politics and personal freedom. The economy is the economy, and that's for wiser people than us to fiddle with. What is economic democracy? Is it possible? Are we going to have any more of that than we have political democracy?
Yeah, well, you see, for the answer to that question, your listeners are all going to have to come to the talk in the University of Hartford, 200 Bloomfield Avenue, is it, or something?
That's right. How about Wednesday, November 4th, around 7:30?
Right. I should also give the day. That's right. No, Wednesday, November 4th. And thank you. I think I got to stop right now.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yes. Well, I wish we had another 2 or 3 hours to chat, but I appreciate this so much, Michael. And looking very much forward to hearing your talk. Thanks for all that you've done, and it's been very much appreciated, and you've been really an inspiration to many of us alienated, disaffected ex-academic types.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, and I hope we can become less alienated, more effective, more determined.
I hope so, too. Okay. Thanks again, Michael.
Right,
bye-bye.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Michael Parenti speaks on civil liberties and economic democracy Wednesday, November 4 at 7:30 p.m. in the Wild Auditorium at the University of Hartford. To reserve your free tickets, call the University box office at 860-768-4228 or toll-free 800-274-8587. That's area code 860-768-4228. Or toll-free 800-274-8587. Look me up and say hi if you come on November 4th. I'll probably be in the booth with the sound engineer. And no, we're just good friends. It'll get in my non-carborundum, and please celebrate a traditional Halloween this year. It's one of the few folk traditions that the capitalists haven't yet destroyed. Ciao!